Hello, and welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Every week, you may have heard me say this before, but I read from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. First, I have a must list, and then they have two long articles that they mention in the must list, so I've got those queued up and ready to go. There are all kinds of end of 2024 lists going on, so I have one to kick us off, but I even have two saved for our next episode. So let's get started with this must list. Day of the Fight, Keira Knightley's new crime drama, and Interstellar back in theaters top this week's must list. Prime Video's Canadian comedy caper The Sticky and a very merry play at New York City's Merchant House round out our picks for the weekend. This is by the Entertainment Weekly staff. It's hard to believe we're officially in 2025 award season. Critics' Choice and Spirit Awards nominations started rolling out Thursday, and the Entertainment Weekly team will be up bright and early on Monday for the Golden Globe nominations announcement. If you're looking for what you need to catch up on to win your office pools, Entertainment Weekly has a slew of new awardist content for you, including two covers. One featuring Unstoppable's Jennifer Lopez and Jerrell Jerome, and another with Fallout's Walton Goggins. Let the holiday awards contender binging commence. That is Patrick Gomez, Editor-in-Chief. Our first item on the must list is the Day of the Fight. Jack Huston's directorial debut taps into the nostalgia of sports films of the past, paying homage to the films Hollywood once celebrated, the underdog who wants a chance at redemption. The new release stars Michael C. Pitt as Irish Mike Flanagan, a champion boxer whose life went astray after an accident that led to him going to jail. Years later, he gets a chance to get back in the ring to prove he's not the guy everyone assumes he is, a decision that may cost him his life. Black Doves, a grieving spy played by Keira Knightley and a broken-hearted assassin played by Ben Whishaw, team up to solve a murder in this lively and hilarious thriller from Joe Barton from The Lazarus Project. Set in London at Christmas time, the 6-episode Netflix series is a brisk and bloody holiday binge. And we read the review for that show last week, and they gave it an A- as a grade. Interstellar re-release. Celebrating the 10th anniversary of Christopher Nolan's sci-fi blockbuster, the Matthew McConaughey and Anne Hathaway-led film is back in theaters this weekend, shown in 70mm IMAX prints as well as digital screens. Sounds quite all right, all right, all right. The Sticky. A struggling syrup farmer, played by Margot Martindale, teams up with a small-time criminal, played by Chris Diamantopoulos, and a dopey security guard, played by Guillaume Cuire, to steal a stash of Canadian maple syrup worth millions. Loosely inspired by a true heist, this 6-episode Prime Video crime comedy is a delicious showcase for its 3 marvelous leads. A Christmas Carol is our last item on the list. John Kevin Jones brilliantly performs Charles Dickens' Christmas classic in the unique, intimate setting of New York City's Merchant House Museum. But an option to stream the one-man show online via the museum's website allows the holiday cheer to spread far and wide. That's our must list this week. Day of the Fight, Keira Knightley's new crime drama, and Interstellar back in theaters top this week's must list. It was by the Entertainment Weekly staff. They mentioned that we can stream Merchant House's A Christmas Carol, and I went to their website to check it out. If we were going in person, the tickets would be $50 to $130 each. We can stream it for $25 as a virtual rental. It says that it allows unlimited views until December 30th, and you can share the link with friends and family. So you can go to Merchant House's museum, that is merchanthouse.org, and that's spelled MERCHANTSHOUSE.org. There should be a link to Christmas Carol in there, or you can follow the address with a / Christmas Carol, all one word, and that should get you to the webpage also. I have both those awardist articles ready to go. The first one here is Fallout Boy. Walton Goggins is reaching new heights and audiences with his ghoulish character. Walton Goggins is feeling good, and it's not because of the Negronis. Okay, the cocktails probably help, but over a mid-October happy hour of focaccia and burrata at a warmly lit Italian restaurant in New York City's West Village, the actor is full of humble enthusiasm over the current state of his career. And for good reason. In between episodes of Fallout, the Prime Video series for which he earned his second Emmy nomination this year, he's found time to return to The Righteous Gemstones as the impeccably costumed former child star hilariously named Uncle Baby Billy, and snag a coveted spot in the Season 3 cast of The White Lotus. After filming that HBO pop culture phenomenon in Thailand earlier this year, Goggins met up with his New York-based family for a vacation in Turkey. It was during that long-awaited moment to breathe that he got an unexpected but real sense of how much his Fallout performance as both struggling cowboy actor Cooper Howard and, after a nuclear apocalypse, the irradiated gunslinger, the Ghoul, has become a breakout hit with audiences around the globe. I've been fortunate to get stopped in public for not really one thing, but a variety of projects over the years. Then, all of a sudden, people were talking about Fallout more than anything else, he tells Entertainment Weekly, of starring in the video game adaptation. There was a moment when I was walking down the street with my wife and my son in Istanbul, where within the span of a block, someone from Iraq who was there on vacation came up, someone from Syria came up, and someone from Kurdistan came up. We were walking and eating baklava after having a glass of wine at a restaurant. Then there were these three encounters, one right after another. We all looked at each other with such love in our hearts and had long conversations. That's when it hit him. We did something that is reaching across countries. It's breaking down those barriers and becoming something that people are sharing in, he says. At this stage of my life, I'm grateful to be part of it. Goggins, 53, is one of film and TV's most prolific actors currently working. Anyone who's seen him in anything, perhaps memorably as antagonist Boyd Crowder on Justified, which earned him his first Emmy nod in 2011, likely has something nice to say about his charming smile or ability to make even the scummiest characters lovable on screen. As Fallout's the Ghoul, Goggins embodies a ruthlessly skilled warrior. A studio head once called it competency porn to me. Fallout co-showrunner Geneva Robertson-Dvorit recalls speaking to Entertainment Weekly during a brief break from season 2 pre-production. People want to see characters who are good at what they're doing. That, to me, is the true delight of the Ghoul. It's so awesome to see Walton be so good at this, even if it's killing. Then there's the other side of Goggins' Fallout performance as Cooper Howard in the show's pre-apocalyptic flashbacks. It's really exciting to have our show do something that the games could not do very well because you can only go to a cutscene so often in a game, says Goggins' Fallout co-star Aaron Moten, who plays the Brotherhood of Steel squire Maximus. We get to create this other world before the bombs dropped. Where many video game adaptations have failed, save the recent run of the Super Mario Bros. Movie and HBO's The Last of Us, the Fallout series takes full advantage of its creative medium while also managing to capture what players love about the long-running series of open-world role-playing games. Fallout game players are able to choose different paths, like building power armor to join the Brotherhood of Steel, or making the most of the protective shelter of the vaults, or taking their chances in the wasteland. The show's three main characters, Goggins the Ghoul, Moten's Maximus, and Ella Purnell's newly emerged vault dweller Lucy, embody those varying approaches to Fallout's apocalyptic landscape. They've all been out on the wasteland a different amount of time, co-showrunner Graham Wagner says of the show's main trio. The Ghoul has been there 200 plus years, while Lucy is a newcomer. There's that old line, "Tell me your zip code, I'll tell you what you believe." Our beliefs and attitudes about the world stem from our environments, and we realize this show was a great opportunity to toy around with that. They're going to look at things a little differently, and we get to explore a very vast and complicated world through three different perspectives and cover more ground quickly. Jonathan Nolan, who developed the Fallout series with Robertson, Dvorak, and Wagner, and also directed the first three episodes, thinks the trio of protagonists provides the perfect meeting ground between the strengths of video games and TV. I love that first-person point of view in video games, where you feel like you are that character, Nolan says. But television is an empathy machine. You can jump between different characters, and you can do that with great faculty. That can be cumbersome in gaming, but it is very easy to do in television. So I thought that was a terrific solution to convey all the moral ambiguity of the Fallout games, but do it in a familiar and time-tested form for television. Playing the video game doesn't require an understanding of what it means to live through a world-changing event. But in March 2020, the world screeched to a halt, and the COVID-19 lockdowns provided a whole new perspective for the Fallout creative team as they developed the series. When the pandemic hit, we talked a lot about how it felt like we had turned into vault dwellers, says Robertson Dvorak, who crafted the show with Wagner and executive producer Jonathan Nolan. We were in hiding as all the essential workers were taking the risks to keep things going. People were saying, it's good to stay home, and yet you felt cowardly doing it, continues the Captain Marvel co-screenwriter. That affected how we related to Lucy. In fact, we worried a lot about if she was too annoying since she came from this world of privilege where people got to hide. But Ella brought such humanity to the performance. There's a sweetness to the way she manifests her naivete that, thank God, people did not find annoying. In fact, when talking to Entertainment Weekly ahead of Fallout's premiere this spring, Purnell had the perfect description of Lucy. Leslie Knope meets Ned Flanders, but in the apocalypse. That last part is the most important because over the course of season one, Lucy learns a lot about her world in a way that changes her. In our real world, different explanations and conspiracy theories still swirl about what exactly caused the COVID-19 pandemic. But the show Fallout differs from the games by telling us what catalyzed their apocalypse. The corporation that built the vaults in the first place. Corporations present an interesting problem because they are these organisms that are only interested in their own survival, and their one duty is to keep making their shareholders money at all costs, Robertson Dvorak says. That is a very problematic thing in a world where they are the most powerful entities. That was something that we thought was worth writing about, adds Wagner, and it's fun for us to be like, and we're going to put it on Amazon Prime. Enmeshed as they are in preparations for season two, Robertson, Dvorak, and Wagner are careful not to say anything too revealing, but they are willing to tease one tidbit. There's more story to tell about Barb, played by Frances Turner, Cooper Howard's wife who worked for Vault Tech before the apocalypse. Goggins has a more practical consideration as he prepares for season two. Returning to Fallout means returning to the makeup chair, where it takes hours to apply his ghoul getup before every day of shooting. I am really scared about getting back into those prosthetics, he says with a laugh in between bites of burrata. It's that old saying where someone asks, why did you decide to have a second kid? Because you totally forgot what it was like to have the first. But in this case, the first has been a golden child. That was Fallout Boy. Walton Goggins is reaching new heights and audiences with his ghoulish character. It was by Christian Haloub. Our other article from The Awardist is Wrestling with Greatness, How Jennifer Lopez and Jarrell Jerome Became Unstoppable in Their New Family Biopic. This year's most inspirational story about NCAA wrestler Anthony Robles, who was born with one leg, and his mom, Judy, will have you crying and cheering. This is by Jared Hall. Jarrell Jerome distinctly remembers the time, near the end of filming his new movie, Unstoppable, that he took to the mat to wrestle Anthony Robles, the NCAA championship-winning athlete he portrays in the biopic. We don't talk about that day, the actor tells Entertainment Weekly. It didn't go well for me. That's the first time I saw Anthony really be nice to somebody on the mat. I definitely wanted to feel what the other wrestlers felt wrestling him. Brute and monstrous is how Jerome describes the champion wrestler, qualities that propelled Robles to the top of his sport and the medal podium in 2011 as a student at Arizona State University. But even more impressive and inspiring is that he did so with just one leg. His congenital disability challenged him in all of the expected ways, so he trained harder than all of his fellow athletes, not just keeping up with, but surpassing their skills, stamina, and strength. But the guy Jerome encountered that day on the mat was starkly different from the one he became close friends with over several years during preparation for the movie. More like the guy he first saw in a YouTube video where Robles was being interviewed outside of his Mesa, Arizona high school. Anthony's such a beast on the mat. He's dominant and he's aggressive, says Jerome, who won an Emmy in 2019 for his lead performance in When They See Us, about the Central Park Exonerated Five. But you watch this video, and he's the complete opposite. He is so kind and sweet, and the smile is so wide, and he has such a big heart. So I'm over here wondering, what is going on? What a duality. I wanted to find the guy beyond the wrestler who wrestled at home. That's what pulled me to it. The wrestling just came with it. It was the obstacles Robles overcame outside the sport since infancy that might truly define him. Robles' mom, Judy, played by Jennifer Lopez, had him as a teenager. When we meet the mother and son in the movie nearly 18 years later, her family includes four more children with her abusive husband, Rick, played by Bobby Cannavale. He's the only dad Anthony has ever known, but he's not the most supportive guy. Jealous, even, that his children idolize their big brother more than their own dad. Unfaithful, controlling, pompous, selfish, and temperamental, he abandons the family at one point, forcing Anthony to forego a full scholarship to Philadelphia's Drexel University so he can stay in the Phoenix area to help support his family. There was a lot about her that I understood, Lopez says, of Judy and her willingness to stay in such a toxic relationship. There were different sides to him that the kids didn't see, that only Judy saw. With those types of people, there's a part of them that fools you into thinking that they care about you and that they truly love you. And it's really about their damage that they're putting onto you. In a brief flashback, we get a small glimpse into Rick's own upbringing, but as Cannavale sees it, compounding the problem is fear, worry that his four sons could end up in the jail where he works. I am cognizant of that feeling. I have three sons myself, and one of them is 29, and my heart's still in my throat for him. I'm afraid for him, Cannavale admits. And that's kind of where I approach the guy from. So whatever the result of that is, they used to call tough love, of course, but I think in that neighborhood, I would pitch him as more than just a run-of-the-mill asshole. Anthony would most certainly disagree with that, and while Cannavale admits Rick is in competition with Anthony for Judy's love and attention, the issues run deeper with her. We talked about that kind of a codependent relationship, Cannavale says, of conversations he had with Lopez, whom he previously worked with on Shall We Dance and Parker. We both acknowledged that we knew what this was, that we had seen this at some point, somewhere in our lives before. The long lens of being older now and seeing that for what it was allows you to really play it almost affectionately, knowing how fraught the relationship is boiling. We both understood what that was. There was a lot going on with the two of them that was dysfunctional and unhealthy, but she loved him and wanted him to be there, Lopez adds. He was the father of four of her children. As angry and upset as she could be at him, she could also welcome him back in a second, like she did in the movie, which was heartbreaking. For all of her nerves about sharing her family's story with the world, Judy Robles says she felt in good hands with Lopez, whom she shared many personal stories with and found a kindred spirit in. She was able to really take on how I felt, the highs and the lows, Judy says of the actress. We long to be loved, and we want something impossible to work out. And even when we see it, and we're like, but I've got to keep pushing. There's always that little bit of hope, she reflects of her marriage. When I watched the movie, when I watched me, I was like, oh yeah, I was pretty weak. I kind of don't want to see that part of me. But I know that was my growth journey. Judy believes that after watching the film, people aren't left with a sense of who I used to be, but who I am now. She says her son is a big part of that evolution, crediting him with helping her rise above her situation to pursue a better life for herself. No surprise, given the bond between the two, who occasionally stop to hold back or even wipe tears during their interview together. I keep reminding myself of the underlying message of it all. It's that word unstoppable. Unstoppable, says Robles, who's now a motivational speaker and ESPN commentator, and wrote the book the movie is based on. There are special people in my life, my mom, my siblings, and my coaches, who helped me wrestle through certain opponents in my life. I hope this film helps someone that's wrestling through something in their lives, that it's going to help them through an opponent. That's what this is all about. Like Robles, the biopic of his life has faced its share of adversity. First announced in pre-production 6 years ago, Unstoppable would have to wait through the COVID-19 pandemic lockdowns before moving forward in 2023 with Ben Affleck and Matt Damon's Artists Equity producing and Oscar-winning editor William Goldberg from Argo making his directorial debut. With a resume that also includes tense dramas such as Zero Dark Thirty and Gone Baby Gone, as well as the boxing biopic Ali, Goldenberg has spent a lot of time editing memorable and physically taxing performances. And he knew how hard Jerome was working to get the wrestling just right, spending months in his intense training with Robles ahead of the start of filming. But then, just weeks into production, the project, like many that year, endured another big delay as the actors and writers guilds went on strike. Goldenberg remembers the agonizing call he had to make to his star. He took a minute when I told him that we got shut down, the director recounts. He just said, I gotta call you back, because it wasn't all the effort he put in, and we're 2 weeks in. He was so emotional about it. He called me 2 hours later and said, I'm just going to use the time to get stronger, to get better. And he did. A very Anthony thing of Jerome to do. But then again, he got to learn by example. I spent time with Anthony before he was even married and had his first child, so I've seen chapters of his life, says Jerome, 27, who was 22 when they met. Even though he isn't an emotional guy, once you spend enough time with somebody, you'll see some things creeping in. It's very tricky playing somebody in real life. There's a sensitivity that belongs there, and there's a respect. They're still a human being. They're not just a project. They're not just work. That respect isn't just about the emotional aspects of his life, but also the physical. Special effects are used to remove Jerome's leg, but he worked with a movement coach. That's Allison Diffier, Goldenberg's wife and a former professional dancer, to learn how Robles not just wrestles, but moves through life, how to walk up and down stairs, how to get out of a car, get in and out of bed, and perform other mundane actions. He doesn't have a prosthetic, and he's chosen that in his life, Jerome says. So for Anthony, those crutches are another pair of legs for him. That's his support. He can beat us all in a race right now on those crutches. It's kind of scary how good he is. So for me, that was a pivotal part of the process. If I looked like I had sprained my ankle 2 weeks ago and I'm just wobbling around on crutches, it would not come off as authentic. We also worked a lot on balance. We worked a lot on me having my hands out and just up on one foot. I actually got real scared that my other leg was going to get super weak over time compared to the other because of how much I was leaning on it. On the mat, Jerome became so good at wrestling that the real wrestlers cast in the movie as Robles' ASU teammates and competitors wondered how long the actor had been involved in the sport. He was never so happy as when the other wrestlers were asking him how long he had been wrestling or if he had wrestled in school, Goldenberg recalls. Believe me, you've never seen anybody happier. Thrilled to be sure, but also terrified, especially for Robles to see the final product of his wrestling efforts. Anthony was my coach. He was my own mentor through the whole entire process. So as I was growing into him, he was there watching it, Jerome says, of their half a year of training, 5 days a week for 4 to 5 hours a day. Don Cheadle, who plays Robles' ASU coach, Sean Charles, had a front row seat to some of that prep work. The first day I met Jarrell was when they were going through one of the choreographed wrestling scenes, and he was so committed and he was wrestling for real, recalls the Crash and Hotel Rwanda star, who spoke with Coach Charles and learned as much as he could about the sport, even hitting the mat himself to get the full experience. I don't want to just be up there bull-essing. I started training as soon as I got the part. It is, I think, probably one of the hardest, if not hardest, sport. It's full body, total intensity, can't ever let up, fast, slow, it encompasses everything. It is one thing to learn wrestling, which is tough in and of itself, but for him to learn my style of wrestling, which is very unique and specific, he was nailing it, says Robles, who remembers days when Jerome would put in a full day of work filming scenes, then head to wrestling practice where he'd get thrown around and slammed on the mat. He was willing to jump in over and over and over and ask every single time, was that right? Was that how you would do it? Just looking for my approval from it, which Jerome got. But there was someone else who it meant even more coming from. It was one thing for Anthony to look at me like, you're getting it. But it was another thing for Judy, who was there often, to come up to me and say, you look like my son. You feel like my son. You are my son. That appreciation is still evident when the Robles see Jerome between wardrobe changes at their Entertainment Weekly cover shoot in West Hollywood, some 6 weeks after the movie's September 6th premiere at the Toronto International Film Festival. They exchange excited hugs and hellos before stepping in front of the camera, along with Lopez, for their laugh-filled group shot. Their bond is strong, forged from shared experiences, personal stories, and trust. But getting there wasn't easy for the real-life mother and son. My mom always used to tell me growing up that God made me this way for a reason, and there were times when I struggled growing up. I kind of felt like I was always fighting something, Anthony says, his voice breaking as he fights back tears, a rare display of emotion. I was fighting something I couldn't see, and I didn't know when it was going to stop, but I just had that faith that there was a plan. And to be here now, I could see that plan. For a while, I thought it was just wrestling. It was just to win a title. It was just to win a gold medal for myself. But as you'll see in the film, it was people. It was these kids that looked up to me. It's not about me. It's about the story. I'm just a vessel to share that story, to share that message, that there is a plan for everybody, that we're all going to face something, and we're all going to feel like we're fighting with no end in sight. I'm just grateful to be able to see it now. Judy, who took charge of her life and future, as seen in an end credits reveal that almost feels like a spoiler to share here, says watching the movie made her realize that its title is also about her. Everything that we went through together individually, I wouldn't change it as hard as it was, as painful as it was, as many times as I cried and just wondered, why am I the one going through this again, week after week, year after year, she says. Going through that was worth it to get to where we are because instead of folding under the pressure and giving up, he and I continued to fight through it. And now audiences get to see what Jerome, Lopez, and company knew all along when the movie opens December 6th in limited release and starts streaming January 16th on Prime Video. It says a lot about the character of someone when people are good and loving and supportive of each other. What they can accomplish, Lopez says. I've been a single mom at times in my life, and I've asked, am I enough for them? And the truth is, all you need is really one good parent to love you. You hear it in Anthony's voice, and look at what he's been able to accomplish. That's what the movie gave me. You are enough. That was Wrestling with Greatness, how Jennifer Lopez and Jarrell Jerome became unstoppable in their new family biopic, and it was by Jared Hall. I am pretty late from the midway point of the show, but I'll still mention that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Entertainment Weekly, and I am reading from their website, EW.com. Did you know that Dick Van Dyke is in a music video? Well, he sure is. Here is Dick Van Dyke dances with his family through emotional reflection on life in new Coldplay video, Could Go Any Day Now. This is by Joey Nolfi. Coldplay has accomplished a monumental feat in the band's new All My Love music video, which emotionally wraps 98 years of Hollywood legend Dick Van Dyke's life into a single 7-minute celebration of his personal and professional achievements. Co-directed by Oscar-winning filmmaker Spike Jonze and Mary Wigmore, the video opens with the lead singer Chris Martin sitting at a piano outside of Van Dyke's home in Malibu, California, where he's eventually joined by members of the Mary Poppins and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang actors' family. As Martin sings the single, lifted from the band's latest album, Moon Music, the footage shifts to a montage showing off photos and footage of Van Dyke throughout history, as well as his various accolades and personal artifacts. I'm acutely aware that I'm, you know, go any day now, Van Dyke later says in an interview portion of the video. but I don't know why it doesn't concern me. I'm not afraid of it. I have that feeling, totally against anything intellectual, that I'm going to be all right. He goes on to savor the life he lived, both on screen and off. I think I'm one of those lucky people who got to do for a living what I would have done anyway, he says. You think how lucky I am. I got to do what I do, play and act silly. After Van Dyke dances with his family and embraces them throughout the clip, the video ends with Martin and Van Dyke singing together at another piano. In addition to the 7-minute clip, Coldplay is also set to release another version of the video on December 13th to honor Van Dyke's 99th birthday on the same day. You can watch Coldplay's new All My Love music video starring Van Dyke through a link in the article on the website. That's Dick Van Dyke dances with his family through emotional reflection on life in new Coldplay video. I said something earlier about Entertainment Weekly releasing some best and worst lists, and here is a pretty quick one. The top 10 wildest movie scenes of 2024. From fire twisters to sandworms and off-the-wall offerings like The Substance and Furiosa, there's plenty to choose from this year. This is by the Entertainment Weekly staff. With 2024 coming to a close, Entertainment Weekly is looking back at this year's wildest, most memorable movie moments. Whether you're into hand-to-hand combat, epic gunfights, giant space worms, or sexually charged sporting events, there was no shortage of jaw-dropping, chest-bursting scenes to celebrate this year. But after passionate debate and much compromise, Entertainment Weekly managed to narrow down the list of 2024's wackiest movie moments to the 10 most unforgettable scenes. See what we came up with and share more of your favorites in the comments section. Match Point in Challengers is our first scene. One of the most riveting action scenes of the year didn't involve explosions, leaps from tall buildings, or other stunt-ridden theatrics. The climax of Challengers builds to a final showdown between pro player Art Donaldson, played by Mike Feist, and his former best friend and tennis washout Patrick Zweig, played by Josh O'Connor. Shot from myriad thrilling angles, including the point of view of the ball itself and from beneath the court, the scene elevates a tennis match to a gripping opera of sex, desire, and competition. Though the sharp editing, the tense Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross score, and the choreography make the tennis itself a breathtaking spectacle, the scene's magic is in Feist and O'Connor's performances as they build to a devilishly surprising payoff that is tennis balls to the wall. The kitchen fight in Monkey Man is next. A chef's knife to the thigh, a head to a stovetop open flame, and a microwave door to the face are among the carnage captured in one sweeping, memorable sequence in the kitchen of a swanky social club in Monkey Man, Dev Patel's audacious directorial feature debut, in which he also stars. His character, Kid, unleashes fury against a group of villainous brutes in the scene as part of a larger campaign of vengeance against the corrupt police chief and insidious spiritual guru responsible for his mother's murder, resulting in one of the most delightfully mental action scenes of the year. Stow away to nowhere in Furiosa. Nearly 10 years after its original release, Mad Max Fury Road still stands as one of the great action movies of the 21st century. George Miller's long-awaited prequel, Furiosa, mostly drove in a different direction this year, eschewing the previous film's non-stop car chase for a thornier story about a young woman seeking vengeance for her stolen childhood. But for one shining battle sequence set atop the moving war rig with a stowaway Furiosa, played by Anya Taylor-Joy, crawling around underneath. Miller proved that, when he wants to, he and his team can still deliver uniquely thrilling action as awesome as anything in Fury Road. This is visual storytelling at its most exciting. Like a modern-day silent film, Miller teaches viewers a lot about Furiosa and Praetorian Jack, played by Tom Burke, through their emotions and expressions. Time to press the bomby knocker. Battle of Arrakeen in Dune, Part 2. By splitting Frank Herbert's Dune into two movies, director Denis Villeneuve gave himself plenty of time to build up audience excitement for the story's epic climax. After the first installment ended with the duplicitous destruction of House Atreides, viewers really needed to see some catharsis, and Villeneuve's team delivered that in spades. From the sight of giant sandworms bursting through the walls of Arrakeen to Zendaya's Chani getting the hero moment that had been prophesied for Paul, played by Timothée Chalamet, to the golden hour duel between rival princes, the action-packed finale of Dune Part 2 fulfilled all its promises. Island Melee in Blink Twice. Is ignorant bliss? Zoe Kravitz's directorial debut Blink Twice emphatically argues no, as the hedonistic party at billionaire Tech King Slater's, played by Channing Tatum's, private island comes to an abrupt and violent end after ambitious cocktail waitress Frida, played by Naomi Ackie, and reality TV star Sarah, played by Adria Arjona, discover Slater and his sycophantic friends had been raping and assaulting them and other women on the island after giving them a drug that erases their memories. There was always an ominous edge to the too-good-to-be-true paradise, but the reality is even more horrifying than they expected. To say the women get their revenge is a massive understatement, and the ways in which they each take out their rage on their attackers in the third act climax are appropriately chaotic, bloody, and primal. Fire tornadoes in Twisters. How do you make a city-destroying twister even scarier? Light it on fire! Summer blockbuster Twisters brought the heat, literally, when meteorologist Kate, played by Daisy Edgar Jones, and tornado wrangler Tyler, played by Glenn Powell, Javi, played by Anthony Ramos, and his storm par colleague Scott, played by David Corenswet, and the rest of their storm chaser caravan attempt to outrun a tornado that collided with an oil refinery. Watching the flames spiral up to become a fire tornado was thrilling and downright terrifying, because that is actually a very real thing that can occur in nature. Thanks for the nightmare fuel, Twisters. Speedboat fight in Roadhouse. The new Roadhouse pulled no punches, or all the punches, depending on how you want to look at it, throughout its entire runtime. But the final showdown between disgraced UFC fighter Elwood Dalton, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, and sociopathic enforcer Knox, played by Conor McGregor, reached new levels of brutality. Between the use of a speedboat as a weapon, the unceremonious and shocking murder of Billy Magnuson's Big Bad, and all that aggressive stabbing with a shard of wood, director Doug Liman made sure to keep audiences gasping and cringing until the very end. Monstro Ilisu takes the stage in The Substance. No other movie this year, with the possible exception of the next entry on this list, ends with a bloody bang quite like this one. For a film already chock full of WTF did I just see moments, The Substance truly manages to outdo itself in its gut-wrenching climax. Despite accidentally transforming herself into a hideous Cronenbergian nightmare creature, TV sensation Sue, played by Margaret Qualley, herself a clone of former Hollywood star Elizabeth Sparkle, played by Demi Moore, limps on stage to perform in her network's prestigious New Year's Eve show. horrified by the monster standing before them, the audience erupts into pandemonium and starts to attack, ripping off limbs and severing heads. An Overlook Hotel elevator's worth of blood drenches terrified onlookers like a firehouse as the creature devolves into a sentient heap of guts and viscera. Ooh. The next on the list, Sky meets the entity in Smile 2. The terrifying sequel to 2022's Smile might not end with as many gallons of blood as The Substance, but it definitely matches its predecessor on this list in terms of pure, high-octane nightmare fuel. Coincidentally, it also involves a stage, a crowded audience, and an indescribable monster from the gates of hell. After being put through the ringer for much of the film's two-hour-plus runtime by the sadistic, supernatural Smile entity, pop superstar Skye Riley, played by Naomi Scott, is losing her grip on reality. Just when she thinks she's finally outsmarted her incorporeal foe by temporarily stopping her heart, thus breaking its curse, the entity reveals she never even had a chance. All of her efforts to save herself were a hallucination, and in reality, she's about to be thrust onto stage to perform for a sold-out crowd. When she steps into the lights, she sees what no one else in the audience can. The entity standing before her in the form of herself. Her evil double then rips open its stomach to reveal the Smile's true form, a giant skinless hydra with multiple grinning heads. Staring into the depths of this cosmic horror, Skye's mind finally breaks, leaving her in a stupefied trance. The creature then rips her mouth open and crawls inside. To her oblivious fans, this all looks like Skye is having a seizure, but when she suddenly stands up, smiles wide, and jams her microphone into her eye socket, all hell breaks loose. Our last item on the list is Deadpool Variant Battle in Deadpool and Wolverine. Deadpool and Wolverine chose a hell of a place to start things off. Three words, bye bye bye. And yet each action sequence that followed continued building momentum like a crazed Tasmanian devil until it climaxed. Ryan Reynolds would have probably used a more sexually explicit term, with an all-out orgy bloodbath. One tracking shot. No camera breaks. About a gazillion Deadpool variants from different universes. All good vibes. No wonder director Sean Levy described this moment as the single most complicated shot in the movie. The filmmaker corralled dozens of extras, and his two stars had to be so in sync as to orchestrate one of the most complex, perfectly timed symphonies of chaos. Pro tip, each time you watch The Wonder, focus on someone else, whether it be Cowboy Deadpool continuously throwing other Deadpools in front of him for protection, or the main merc doing terrible, terrible things to Headpool. True to the title, it did get pretty wild there at the end. Those were the top 10 wildest movie scenes of 2024, and it was by the Entertainment Weekly staff. To wrap us up this week, I have a couple short articles, one TV, one for movies. Harry Hamlin teases Wild Mayfair Witches Season 2. I'm reading the script going, what the F? This is by Maureen Lee Lanker. With the work of Anne Rice, things are always going to get weird. But Season 2 of Mayfair Witches, which returns to AMC and AMC Plus on January 5th, might be the most outlandish bit of the author's universe yet. At least, it is for Harry Hamlin, who stars as Mayfair patriarch Cortland. I have a long and very interesting journey in this season, Hamlin told the audience at the season 2 premiere on Thursday night, co-hosted by Entertainment Weekly and AMC at the Masonic Lodge at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery. I didn't know how much of it until I read the script, the script would come in one after the other, kind of slowly, and all of a sudden I'm reading the script about halfway through and I go, what the F? When last we saw Cortland, Rowan, played by Alexandra Daddario, had turned him to stone, but he will still be present in season two. I do come out of that, he teases. In fact, Cortland will face some of his own daddy issues with the introduction of Julian Mayfair, played by Ted Levine, who we know from The Silence of the Lambs. He's a very intimidating presence, says Hamlin of Levine, at least in your mind before you meet him, because he was Buffalo Bill. The scenes that I had with Ted are some of my most favorite scenes I've ever done in my career. He's an extraordinary actor, but he also brings this really weird presence to the screen. While Hamlin might bring Levine's past roles to bear in their work, one of Hamlin's own former characters has already received a nod on this show, a fact which Hamlin sought confirmation of from showrunner Estes Spaulding. Early in his career, Hamlin garnered fame for starring as demigod and Greek hero Perseus in the 1981 cult classic Clash of the Titans. Thank you very much for the homage to Clash by turning Cortland into stone, which wasn't in the original script, Hamlin told Spaulding. I'm assuming maybe somebody said, he turned the Kraken into stone, maybe we should turn him into stone? Is that what went through somebody's mind? That's exactly right, Spaulding confirmed. Other members of the cast were also on hand to celebrate season two, including returning star Tongai Krisa, who plays Kryperion Greave. New cast members Ben Feldman and Alyssa Jurels were in attendance as well to discuss their new characters, Sam Lark Larkin and Moira Mayfair. Executive producer Mark Johnson, who oversees the entire Anne Rice universe for AMC, also joined the conversation. Mayfair Witches returns to AMC on Sunday, January 5th at 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific Time. That was Harry Hamlin teases Wild Mayfair Witches Season 2, and it was by Maureen Lee Lenker. For my last article, this is from the movie section, Amy Adams' High Threshold for Embarrassment helped her get into Night Bitch character. This is by Lauren Huff. Amy Adams isn't afraid to get her paws dirty. The 6-time Oscar nominee tells Entertainment Weekly that her high threshold for embarrassment came in handy while making her latest film, Night Bitch, which sees her character, Mother, gradually turn into a dog. I really think it's my responsibility not to judge the situation that my characters find themselves in, but also to find what feels authentic and true about it, she explains. And I think, although I haven't had the unique experience of actually turning into a dog, I think the human experience is pretty strange. And I think the more we talk about the strange things that happen to us at any given time in our life, it becomes strangely relatable. Throughout the Black Comedy, which hails from writer-director Mariel Heller and is based on Rachel Yoder's novel of the same name, Mother finds herself in an increasingly surreal reality after she pauses her career to raise a family. She starts sprouting hair in odd places, craving raw meat, hating cats, and barking, growling, and digging in the yard, and those are just some of the antics. She continues, not to say she's not doing strange things, but I have definitely done things that have made people stop and look twice, so I think I identify with having a high threshold for embarrassment. Pressed for examples of when that high threshold has come in handy, the star, 50, first sights doing spontaneous cartwheels in public when she was younger before then settling on, mostly it involves singing, probably, breaking out into song, yeah, if I'm being honest. Besides finding common ground with her character, Adams says making Night Bitch was a cathartic process. One scene in particular stands out. Toward the end of the film, during a dinner out with old friends she no longer relates to, Mother finally unleashes her frustrations and lets it all out in a feral moment of female rage. "It was absolutely cathartic," Adams says of the scene. Mary Heller talks about it a lot, about saying things out loud that we're not supposed to say out loud. And I think with Mother, this deep sense of loss of self and feeling invisible, I think that's something that a lot of people can identify with at different times in their life, whether it's through parenthood or not. It's an interesting journey. Adams also hopes audiences will connect with the film even though they don't have children. I think in a way the film can also be seen as an allegory because there are these times I know in my life, and I know in the people that are close to me in their lives, where you're sort of in between places. "You're not who you were, but you're not who you're going to be," she explains. It's this very strange place of struggle and a place of great release, ultimately. But it takes a while to find release in the floating in between two places. Night Bitch, also starring Scoot McNairy, Zoe Chow, Mary Holland, Ella Thomas, Archana Rajan, and Jessica Harper, is now playing in theaters. That was Amy Adams' High Threshold for Embarrassment helped her get into the Night Bitch character, and it was by Lauren Huff. I said that was our last article, and that is the case. That's the end of the time we have for Entertainment Weekly this week. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury, and I've been reading from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. Thank you for listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. Come back next week, and you'll hear more about the best and worst of 2024. I have the articles already picked out. So until then, goodbye.